to the Faith Driven Investor Podcast. If you're a fund manager, investor, financial advisor, or business owner driven by your faith or want to be driven by your faith, then you're in the right place. This is a podcast brought to you by Faith Driven Investor. The best way to stay connected about new episodes and new content for Faith Driven Investors is to sign up for our monthly newsletter at faithdriveninvestor.org. This podcast doesn't exist without you, our community. Please send us any thoughts that you have about how this podcast and our site might better serve you or any questions you might have about being a faith-driven investor.
All opinions expressed on this podcast, including the team and guests, are solely their opinions. Host and guest may maintain positions in the companies and securities discussed. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as specific investment advice for any individual or organization.
The investor is a servant leader. The entrepreneur is doing the hard work. And our role as an investor is to come alongside, and Henry, you would say, love on them, to understand their heart, understand their journey, see how we can be part of their journey with introductions, with capital, with advice, with perspective, right? Lifting the fog of war. And that's how we need to think about our roles, which is as servant leaders, not the gurus on top of the mountain. So when we get together and pray, we're praying for opportunities for God to show us how to be better servant leaders to the entrepreneurs that we come in contact with.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Faith Driven Investor Podcast. Today, we're going to hang out with one of our friends, Frank Chen. He stopped by to talk about how he's helping entrepreneurs change the world at the Silicon Valley venture powerhouse of Andreessen Horowitz. As Frank describes it, they're helping entrepreneurs build software companies that are eating the world. He'll give us a little more about that and what it means in our interview. Frank is a self-proclaimed former product and user experience design junkie with specialties in venture capital across many areas: AI, machine learning, product planning, product launches, product development. He understands enterprise software, pretty good at UX design, web hosting and managed services, obviously. And while we're here, he's going to talk about fundraising and what it means to be a faith-driven investor. With a breadth of expertise like that, you can see why we were excited to have him on the show. So let's listen in as we speak with our friend, Frank Chen.
Frank, thank you for being with us.
Henry and William, thank you for having me. It's such an honor and delight to be on the show. I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller. So let's see how it goes.
You know, let's start off in telling people a bit about what you do and what you're an expert in on the investing side. You're in a space that's really interesting, artificial intelligence. There are a number of different things you know well. There are other functions that you perform at Andreessen, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But tell us about artificial intelligence. It's become a buzzword. A lot of us are reading about it. Some of us as entrepreneurs are trying to figure out how to get involved in it and incorporate it into our businesses. Give us an overview.
Great. So why don't I start with what I do here at the firm? So we're a software-focused venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, and we invest in great entrepreneurs who want to rewire their industries with software. As you said, software eating the world. That was an op-ed that Mark Andreessen, one of our co-founders, wrote for the Wall Street Journal, I think 9 years ago now. And it's been our North Star ever since. So my role at the firm, here's the way I think about it. Entrepreneurs are trying to raise money and they will knock on our doors. And I have the great honor and privilege of opening the door and asking them, what do you want the money for? How will you use it? How will you build a great software company using not only our money, but our knowledge and our relationships? And I basically reach out, grab them by the hand and walk them through our house. And, you know, a certain number of them will actually get funding. But even the ones that we don't, we want to make sure that we are really serving them on their journey. Look, entrepreneurship is one of the hardest things that people endeavor to do, right? The journey from zero to one, from nothing to something, really mirrors the creative work that our God does. And it's one of the hardest things that people get called to do. And so all the help that they can get along the way, I think, is appreciated. And we want to be part of that support system for entrepreneurs.
So that's interesting. You talk about this special privilege about being able to talk to an entrepreneur and endeavor to understand what they're doing and how they'd use the money. Tell us more about that special privilege, because you're meeting with somebody. I've been on the other side. I've looked to raise money from firms like Andreessen. And there's a moment of kind of like vulnerability And it's a very pivotal time in an entrepreneur's life. And you're invited into that moment. You're a part of that moment. I get a sense that you understand the gravity of it a bit.
For most of our listeners, you probably know that Henry went 0 for 40 in this category. So he's still harboring a little resentment, trying to figure out what happened 20 years ago. Can I learn even now?
Well, there's some part of that. I got to tell you, I don't think that any of the venture capitalists that we talked to back then loved on us the way that I think that Frank does. But yeah, I remember, those are one of those emotional memories of feeling exposed and feeling like you've got something that you really believe in and you want somebody else to believe in. That's a special time. Tell us more about that.
It is an incredibly special time, and vulnerability is a great word to describe it. And when we start training for everybody that opens the door on our side to entrepreneurs who are knocking, that's the way I begin the training, which is you have to understand this meeting that you're about to go into. And you especially have to understand, even if you're doing it at volume, right? Which is you might be doing this 5-10 times a week, or maybe 5 times a day. Yep. And so let me take you into the heart of somebody who is on the road raising money. You're absolutely right. It's very vulnerable. You've heard a lot of no's. You're walking up and down the street from people who are doing this at volume, right? So there's a bit of the doctor's office, hurry up and wait, and maybe I don't know what the next step is, right? All up and down the road. And so you have to understand that psychology, because if you don't understand that psychology, then you can't really be an effective help for them as they're going through this process. And so first, understand the vulnerability, right? It's no all day long. You feel like you are trying to convince somebody of this grand vision, but none of it is built yet, right? So you don't have proof, you don't have metrics, you don't have, in some cases, you don't have a product. And so all you have is a vision, and you're trying to get people to come along for the ride. And it's deeply personal. In fact, one of the things that we look for in our investments is what we call founder product fit. So the question really is, why are you building this product? So when we spend the first hour with an entrepreneur, we'll go 15, 20 minutes into their background, like their deep background. I'll ask them, where were you born? What set of life experiences led you to building this company? Why are you uniquely suited to build the company that you're about to build? And what we're really listening for is deep commitment, right? So here's sort of the way I think about it. Here are the bookends, right? One is deep commitment, which is I am all in on this. You know, for people of faith, they would think God has called me to this. For people who don't have the faith background, they're like, look, every big life experience has led me to this point, and I have to build this company. I can't think of anything else. I'm waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about how this is a huge problem for lots of people that I need to solve, and I'm uniquely qualified to do it. And the reason we're looking for that amount of commitment, so that's one end of it, right? I'm all in. The other end of it is, hey, I did this spreadsheet in my MBA class, and it looked like the expected outcomes for this thing that I'm on is going to be the biggest of all of the things that I looked at, right? I kind of think of that as loose commitment, which is, maybe that's how I make a lot of money. So we're looking for the deep commitment, your mind, body, soul, you're all in. And the only way to hear that is to understand the deep background, which is why we spend 15, 20 minutes talking about what set of life decisions led you here. And it's funny because when we do this long journey, people aren't usually used to talking about their backgrounds in this way. And I can sort of see them twitching anxiously, waiting to get to the pitch and the idea and the use of funds and all of that. But we say, slow down. We can't invest until we understand why. Until we understand you and the why.
Founder product fit, I haven't heard of that before. Of course, most of the listeners will understand the product market fit. That's talked about a lot. But there's something deeply personal about the why. You just mentioned the question, why? Why are you doing this? The spreadsheet is not going to help them through the valley of shadow of death.
That's exactly right.
The passion and why will.
The people who did the expected outcome analysis and are only shallowly committed to their thing, they're the ones that are most likely to give up when the going gets rough. And look, the way I think about startups is you think this is the psychology of a founder, right? We're going to be the biggest thing in the world. Like, we're definitely Facebook. And then, oh, it's over. It's like, it's done. I'm cooked. It's over. oh, we're going to be bigger than VMware, like for sure. Like we're going to be bigger than VMware. And then, oh, like I'm screwed. It's over. Everybody's quitting. We're done. And then you go and have lunch, right? Like that's the life of an entrepreneur, is that you're on this like incredible roller coaster. And the only way to survive that roller coaster and get to build a durable company, which is what venture investors want to fund, is that you have founder product fit, right? Which is you feel uniquely equipped and called to build this company. Because that's what's going to get you through the rough times.
Take us into the odds of a founder. So when you're looking at it from an investment perspective, how many investments you make, why this is so important, because the odds that an entrepreneur faces to build a company and how you look at it from putting a portfolio together.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the hardest things in the world. I remember I took our kids to the Sacramento Valley one summer and we were looking at some exhibit about the life of salmon and, you know, millions of eggs hatch and the astronomical odds that a salmon has to survive to get back to their breeding ground. And entrepreneurship is like that. You're swimming upstream every day against great odds. And so to put some numbers on it, you know, we'll meet a couple thousand entrepreneurs a year. We will write something like 30 to 50 checks, right? Of the checks that we write, maybe 40% of them fail, right? And so like you think of this extreme winnowing, right? Thousands to 50, and then 50 to like 40% of them don't, you know, give us the capital back. So there's an extreme winnowing effect that entrepreneurs go through. And so again, this goes to the, why are you building this company, right? Because this is one of the most difficult and unlikeliest things for people to do.
So one of the things that I love about you, Frank, that is unique, which makes me wish that you're doing what you're doing now 20 years ago when we were trying to raise venture capital, is that you're not just focusing on the 20 to 30 or 30 to 50, you said, of the checks you're going to write. You, in the process that you lead at Andreessen, are focused on how do you delight and how do you serve the rest. And knowing you and your character, I know that you view this as a ministry of sorts. Tell us how you do that. I'm thinking about the NPS. I'm thinking about how you are able to lean into this vulnerable moment, even when you are working with, or maybe especially when you're working with an entrepreneur that really doesn't have that type of founder product fit. And yet, there you are. You're with them in this vulnerable spot. What do you do with it and how do you measure it?
Yeah, that's a great question that I've been thinking about for the almost 10 years that I have been doing this. I have no claim to perfection, but here's a few things that I have learned along the way. So one is you have to understand the psychology, the vulnerability, the unlikeliness of it, that you're hearing no's all day. And so if you get yourself into that mindset, then you're going to have a much more productive and fruitful meeting with an entrepreneur. Then if you come to it thinking, hey, I have a checklist of things that I need to get through to get the investment committee informed about whether we're going to move forward or not, right? So it's the heart mentality as opposed to the checklist mentality. And you have to sort of blend those. And the way that we've basically kept ourselves honest on this, which is if our goal is to deliver a great experience every time an entrepreneur knocks on that door and do that thousands of times a year, the only way we know how to make sure that we're doing that is to measure and keep people accountable to delivering that great experience. And so one of the things that I started doing early here for the team is measuring net promoter score. So it's the exact same question that Apple or Comcast or your bank will ask you, right? Would you recommend us to friends and family?
Tell us, some number of our listeners aren't going to know exactly what net promoter score is.
Yeah, so Net Promoter Score is a measure that mostly consumer companies use to measure the satisfaction that people have with your product. And the way it works is you ask this question, would you recommend us to friends and family? So I just got an iPhone, would you recommend it? Scale from 1 to 10, 8, 9, and 10 are promoters. And I can't remember exactly how the scale works. There's sort of neutral in the middle, and then there's detractors at the end. And the way the NPS measure works, it's the percentage of people who are promoters minus the percentage of people who are detractors. Mm-hmm. And so if you are world class in delighting customers, like you're an Apple or a Costco or a USAA, you're in the 70s and 80s, right? You are mostly promoters who are saying, yes, I'd love, like you've got to have an iPhone or you've got to subscribe to this USAA credit card. And then if you are not delighting your customers, if you're an ISP or a wireless carrier or a bank, right? It's literally possible to be like negative 10, right? You have more detractors than promoters. And so we use this as a way to basically make sure that we're delivering a great experience to every entrepreneur every time that we meet. And so every person on my team, after they meet with an entrepreneur, the entrepreneur will get the survey question, and we track and measure that over time. Of course, we look for comments that will help us get better at delivering a great experience. And, you know, having looked at hundreds of comments over the last decade, there's really no secret. Here's the straightforward thing that you can do to, quote unquote, win your NPS. You show up on time. You understand the heart and the fragility and the psychology of your entrepreneur. And then even if you're going to say no to funding, you give them something actionable and useful for their business. Because the great privilege we have is we're meeting lots of entrepreneurs who are competing and building companies in that space. And so what we can do is reflect back, you know, anonymized without giving private information. Here's what's happening in your space. And here's intelligence that you might not have. I kind of think of you're playing this video game, and you know how these video games, some of them start with a map where you can only see where your character is and you don't see the rest of the world. So what we can do is basically lift that fog of war or show you more of the map that you might otherwise see because of this privileged position that we're in. And so if you basically give people that back, then they're going to be delighted with the experience.
What is your Net Promoter Score?
So mine has varied over time. So, you know, I'm hoping to consistently do 60 or 70.
Yeah.
We have some new kids who start out and they're like still at 100, which is, you know, I'm waiting for their first neutral or detractor. And so, you know, the trading is working. I will have to say, like, good confession, there was a period where it got as low as 10 or 20. And that was sort of a real crisis moment for me, which is we did training, we did practice, we did rehearsal, we did best practices. We now have this archive of if you're going to close the loop with somebody in email on a no decision, here's a template. Here's sort of an example. You know, we have dozens of examples.
Yeah.
And the examples get built when we send an email and then we get an email reply back saying, honestly, that was the best rejection I have ever gotten, like in life, not just in business, not just in fundraising. And so we enshrine those as, you know, here's an example of how you can really be, you know, a servant leader to the people that you come into contact with.
Didn't I read a story? I'm going back years ago. I'm pretty sure it was Andreessen Horowitz. Don't you guys fine your employees for being late to meetings?
We do. This was something Mark and Ben stood up in the early days. And, you know, the design point for the firm for them was they wanted to design a firm that they would have wanted to raise money from. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that frustrated them with some of the other firms that they pitched is, you know, you sit in the lobby and you wait just like a doctor's office until the doctor has time for you. And look, when you're an entrepreneur, one of the things that is true is you're in a race against time. Like, you don't have time. Like, that's the one thing you don't have. You will eventually get funded. You will eventually find customers. You will eventually build a product. You do not have more time. And so to be cooling your heels in a venture lobby until the general partner has time for you is endlessly frustrating. And so they said, look, how do we program against that? Real simple, $10 a minute. If you're late for a meeting with an entrepreneur, we charge you $10 a minute. And that got set in the culture. We collected the fines more than a couple of times. And, you know, once people get fined a couple of times, they'll stop that behavior. And so to this day, 10 years in, meetings start on the dot.
Oh, that's great. That's beautiful. And I can't get over the fact that you guys are getting such positive net promoter scores from people who you don't invest in. So you said no, and they still like you. That's awesome.
Yeah, we like to sort of, maybe this is too snide a joke, but we like to say we're revolutionizing venture capital with common courtesy, which is if you stop back and think about it, like, we're not doing anything that dramatic. We're just saying, look, let me understand the heart of the person coming in and let me make sure that we deliver a great experience to them, right? It's common sense. It's common courtesy.
Let's shift gears for a minute. I know you've gotten a chance to invest, and artificial intelligence is a big part of what you do as an investment philosophy. Could you take us into that world a little bit and why you think it's so interesting to invest in right now, and just maybe some general overviews of what you're seeing in the space, both as an investor and also from a Christian worldview?
Yeah, fantastic. Let's talk about that. So the first thing that I'll say is that if you read headlines about artificial intelligence or machine learning, you'll read primarily one of two headlines. Headline one is the robots are coming for your jobs, and so we're all going to be unemployed in 10 years. And then after the robots have all of the jobs, then Skynet comes for your children, right? In other words, the computers get so good, they decide that human beings are superfluous or counter to their own aims, and they self-actualize. And so those are very scary headlines. We have no idea how to build any of that technology. And so the way I think about artificial intelligence is it's a set of very useful computer science techniques that's getting inside all of the software in exactly the same way that database technology got inside all of the software beginning in, let's call it, the 1950s, but really accelerating in the 1980s with the advent of relational databases, right? So if you think about everything you do on the internet, buying something from Amazon, going to Starbucks, booking a room, all of that is based on a database somewhere. And it turned out to be this incredibly useful set of techniques that got better and better. And artificial intelligence is like that, which is computer science techniques, not Skynet. And the things that computer science techniques are enabling us to do are things that databases could never do, right? So if you had a database, you could ask it the question, hey, how many emails did Henry send yesterday? Great database question. With artificial intelligence, we can say, of the emails that Henry wrote, which ones is he nervous about? Wow, that is fascinating that we could ask and answer that type of question with algorithms. Or another example, I'm looking at a picture. What is inside this picture? Or I'm looking at somebody who's just applied for a loan. How likely are they to repay the loan? A great example here is we have an investment in a company called Branch that makes loans to people with no credit backgrounds, right? So if you or I apply for a loan, they'll search our credit bureau history and they'll decide whether you're loan worthy. There's lots of countries where that infrastructure doesn't exist. So if you are in Mexico or Tanzania or India, there is no credit bureau record about you. And so what this company does, Branch, is look at your behavior on the phone. And it turns out that if you receive more texts than you send, you are more likely to repay your loan than somebody who has that reversed. Or if you're careful with your battery, in other words, you don't burn through it and you're done by lunch, you're more likely to repay your loan. And so they're looking for these behavioral clues as to whether you are more creditworthy. And it's this type of question that artificial intelligence can now answer that databases couldn't. And that's just going to squeak through all of the software that we write and make the software that we write better and better. And that's definitely something that we are very bullish about as investors.
So tell us, what is the future of work? What does this mean for us? I'd like to look at it through two different lenses. One is, what does it mean for us who have jobs that are out there? So expand on that about, you know, the people from the sky coming and taking our children. So what does that mean for us? Is this the end of work as we know it, and therefore we just, you know, just have to hunker down? Or does it create new opportunities for us? What does that look like? And then what do you see if I'm an entrepreneur or a business owner and I'm looking at this new development and this new revolution? Where are generally some of the opportunities that you see for the average business owner to think about bringing artificial intelligence to make their product or service better? So first through the lens of employees and then through the lens of a business owner.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the future of work because I think all of our jobs will get safer, will be equipped to make better decisions, will actually get superpowers in the physical world. So let me walk through some examples of how I think work changes once we have machine learning everywhere. So one example is, you know, look, there are lots of dangerous jobs out there that we can either eliminate or change the nature of. So here's a super obvious dangerous job. If you are a soldier and you are asked to run into a building that you've never run into before, looking for people, that's called clearing the building, right? That's what the Department of Defense calls it. It is the most dangerous job we ask you to do as a soldier. We ought to have drones do that, right? We should not have 22-year-olds with M16s running into buildings blind. We ought to have drones do it. So that's sort of an obvious job that is dangerous that will get automated. And then there are jobs that are not obviously dangerous, but turn out to be. So The most dangerous job, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is long-haul trucking, which is to say, not only are you likely to get into some kind of accident driving the truck, but the health outcomes of a long-haul trucker, right? Think about the long-haul trucker that is in the cab all day, not eating well, away from home, stressed, right? So the obesity percentages of long-haul truckers is through the roof. And so as a result, the health outcomes of having that job, and there's a huge truck driver shortage in this country now because we're all addicted to Amazon Prime. As a result, young people are seeing the statistics saying, I don't want to be a long-haul trucker. That is a dangerous job. And so eventually we will get to the point where the trucks drive themselves, and that's fantastic, right? So that's one area where the future of work gets better. Another area that the future of work gets better is I think we can do more creative work as more and more of the routine work gets automated. So for instance, you go visit your doctor, there's a lot of routine work where they're basically filling out your electronic health record. They're asking you all these questions, they're hunched over their laptop, they're typing and typing and typing. What I really want the doctor to do is pay attention to me and be creative and be thinking about all the symptoms that I have. I don't want them typing my blood pressure into a spreadsheet somewhere. And so if we have machine learning systems that are listening to the conversations that we're having and attached to the equipment that's in their office, all of the electronic health records can get updated automatically and the doctor can really pay attention to me. So think about the human interaction, think about the creativity. And the way I'll say it to this community is there's a bunch of stuff that will get automated, which is great, right? Routine, rote work that's very rule-based. The things that won't get automated are the things that we would call the fruit of the spirit, right? It's love and joy and peace and kindness and goodness and faithfulness. Those things we have no idea how to automate. And so more and more of our jobs will be about those things that are hard to automate. So here is a loan decision or a loan recommendation that comes out of a machine learning algorithm. On top of that, we overlay the fruit of the spirit. Let me understand somebody's background and see if this recommendation makes sense. Because maybe there's a hardship. Maybe there's a life circumstance that the algorithms didn't understand, and we now need to overlay our love and our compassion over a machine learning recommendation. And so I think more and more of our work will be, how do we handle these exception cases? How do we decide if the learning algorithms are making a recommendation that makes sense in this specific instance? And so I'm excited about sort of us being able to bring, you know, the things that make us like our creator, love and compassion, to the workplace.
And as we get near our time, I also want to ask, you've given a presentation before about some version of, hey, technology has been blamed for taking all the jobs for hundreds of years. You know, it's every 20 years, you can pull the headlines and technology is going to take all the jobs and it happens every time, right? And I remember you put up a compelling list. I'm going to remember one of them, but maybe you could riff on a few more, which were things like, look, nobody knew that there'd be millions of drivers from Uber and Grab and Lyft and all these types of organizations. No one knew that that would be a job that you could make a lot of money 10 years ago. And that was technology that, while it displaced some, it enabled so many more and created a whole new category that no one even knew existed. And maybe you could talk a little bit more about some of those.
Yeah. And the overarching thing that I'll say before I launch into a couple of examples is our ability to sort of predict backwards to which jobs get eliminated is pretty good. Our ability to predict forward to see the new jobs that get created is pretty poor. So when you saw the Model T for the first time, you could very well conclude, wow, if you are a saddle maker, you are in trouble, right? Look, the car is going to replace the horse. That's pretty clear. There is no way that you would have predicted that the largest private employer in the United States would be Walmart. But that happened directly on the back of the Model T. Right? With no cars, there would be no suburbs. With no suburbs, there would be no big box retailers. Without big box retailer, right? It's a direct line, but our ability to predict those things, because we are not God, is very, very limited. So some fun examples of jobs that didn't exist, and I'll do sort of, here's jobs that didn't exist 30 years ago. Zumba instructor. a well-being coach, a wind turbine technician, an MR imaging technician, a genetic counselor, right? These things just didn't exist 30 years ago. Flash forward 20 years ago, things that didn't exist that are jobs that millions of people have now. Blogger, search engine optimization specialist, data scientist, hydraulic fracturing engineer, YouTube content creator. And then flash forward 10 years ago, as you mentioned, you couldn't have been a Lyft driver, or you couldn't have been an Airbnb host. You couldn't have been a college admissions consultant or a drone pilot. And so technology has this way of creating lots of opportunities that we have a hard time seeing. And so it's a lot easier to write the headline, "The robots are coming for your jobs," than it is to say, "Here's brand new categories of jobs that we didn't even know were going to exist." And then, you know, one last story I'll tell about this, which is, even with the jobs that we think are going away with technology, we turn out to be pretty poor predictors. And so one of my favorite stories from this is, when we started putting the automated teller machines in the banks, you would have expected the number of bank tellers in the country to basically fall to zero, right? Which is, look, here's the cash machine. You don't really need a bank teller anymore. But it turns out that if you actually look at the data set, the number of bank tellers until very recently continued to climb ever since the 1970s when the ATMs got into the banks. And the reason for it was this, which is the banks decided that, hey, look, now that we can automate some of what happens in a bank, I can open a branch profitably in your neighborhood. And so basically what happened from the 70s to today is banks fell over each other to open a branch near your house, and that would be how they would compete. And of course, every time you opened up a branch, you needed to hire tellers. Now, you'd have ATMs in there for sure, and you could hire fewer tellers. But it turns out the number of bank tellers in the country increased, even though we automated a lot of those jobs. And I think the nature of what a bank teller does now, I think, is about empathy and understanding you and looking you in the eye on loan decisions. And I think that's exactly what we want people doing, which is, we are so far uniquely situated to understand each other's motivations and to understand each other's hearts. And that's exactly the situation that we want people to be in.
William's going to take us to a close here in a second and ask you about what God is speaking to you in your life through his word. Before we get there, though, I want to first say that was great. It was a terrific overview. I think it's really, really important for us to understand the role of the fruit of the Spirit, not just necessarily as an investor. Most of the people on this podcast aren't venture capitalists. And yet, to think about how we might have an overlay in our jobs of the fruit of the Spirit is super important, lest we otherwise think of the businesses that we do as transactions. The desire to be able to delight those that we serve, or even those we let down as a ministry, is something I think that we can all take away from. One of the things that I want to touch on briefly is this ministry that you have with Josh Kwan, where you bring together people at your church that are in the venture capital industry, other venture capitalists, to pray together and to share together. And I think that a lot of people will be surprised about that. Venture capitalists as a whole aren't necessarily thought of as the most warm and fuzzy and redemptive. maybe not. But you've really leaned into that. What does that look like?
Yeah, I agree that the stereotype of the venture capitalist is we're the guru on top of a mountain, and an entrepreneur survives several life-threatening challenges to get an audience with the guru. And when they arrive, we extend the hand and say, "You may kiss the ring," right? Like, that's the stereotype. Yes. The counter image, or what we're trying to do here and with the other investors, is reverse that and say, look, no, the investor is a servant leader. The entrepreneur is doing the hard work. And our role as an investor is to come alongside, and Henry, you would say, love on them, to understand their heart, understand their journey, see how we can be part of their journey with introductions, with capital, with advice, with perspective, right? Lifting the fog of war. And that's how we need to think about our roles, which is as servant leaders, not the gurus on top of the mountain. So when we get together and pray, we're praying for opportunities for God to show us how to be better servant leaders to the entrepreneurs that we come into contact with.
So bridging on that, also, Andreessen Horowitz has an office on Sand Hill Road, which is this road that when you talk about going up and down the street, this this road that Dave and I came out to 20 years ago and went up and down it and went 0 for 40 on it. And you talk about being the guru on the top of the mountain. Well, you guys are actually on the top of the hill. You're in a unique spot here in Silicon Valley to be able to see what's going on in trends in technology and generally in software and pretty much anything. From your vantage, what do you see God doing? Are you hopeful? Are you concerned? What do you see God doing in Silicon Valley, a place that is thought of as being hostile to the gospel? What are you seeing? How's the Spirit of God working in Silicon Valley?
You know, Henry, I am very hopeful about what God is doing. And, you know, I have you to thank a lot for sort of opening my eyes to sort of what people are doing, integrating their work and their faith lives. I'm excited about organizations like Praxis. I'm excited about what you guys are doing at Sovereigns to sort of say, look, we can actually be investors on the one hand and committed Christians, Christ followers on the other. And that's not a contradiction. I would say we've got prevailing headwinds. I would say there is a dominant religion in Silicon Valley, which I would call techno-optimism, which is to say that, look, technology is going to solve all of humanity's problems. And we're just one startup away from solving the deep, deep issues. And I would say, look, those are headwinds that we live in. And we just have to acknowledge that for the entrepreneurs around us, that's probably how they're thinking about the world. And, you know, my counter argument to it is, look, I am a technology optimist for sure. If you look at one of my favorite graphs in the world is just go look at per capita income since the time of Christ. So just go Google that right now. And basically, people had no real wealth until the 1800s, right? Which is, of course, there was wealth, but it was very unevenly distributed. Very few people had wealth. And so technology has made it possible for people to enjoy lives that are unimaginable to their grandparents, even just their grandparents, right? But going back generations and generations. And so I am a technology optimist, but I am also cognizant that technology cannot solve the ultimate problem. It's not going to solve the sin nature. Anytime you have a technology, it will create new ways for the sin nature to sort of unleash itself. And so you think about the telephone, the telegraph, the newspaper, eBay, Craigslist, all of these sort of ways to connect people. It created new ways for people to unleash sin on each other. And so, look, technology cannot solve the root problems that we have because that's not the way God set up the universe. But we have an opportunity to use technology to make each other's lives better and more connected and more fulfilling and more uplifting. And let's figure out how to do that. And that's how I think about my role here on top of the hill, coincidentally, as you point out.
And one of the things we like doing, we close. So from the top of the hill, where is God taking you right now? Is there a scripture? Is there something in God's word that's maybe coming alive right now in the last, could be this morning, could be the last few days, maybe the season that maybe you're looking at a little differently that he's driving you through right now?
Yeah, there is a verse, it's James 1:19 that has been particularly impactful for me in this season. It says, know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And the reason that's resonating with me now is it's kind of the antidote to the valley. The valley is do everything quick, right? Build things quick and break things and fail fast and everything needs to be quick and go and go and go and go and go. And so for me, the antidote to that, which is I don't want to get in the way of progress and I don't want to get in the way of an ambitious entrepreneur who has that drive and energy, right? We need the Moses Aaron combos in our world, but there's also a counterbalance to it, which is be quick to hear, really understand people and understand where they're at, slow to speak, so that you can meet them and kind of be a counterweight to the, look, I'm always in a hurry and I've got to go. So that verse has been resonating with me.
Amen.
That's awesome.
I would love to say I'm slow to speak, but I'm pretty confident my wife would massively disagree. So I will meditate on that myself as well.
Frank, you've blessed us. And I'm grateful for our friendship. I'm grateful for your leadership in the Valley. I'm grateful for the way you have modeled loving entrepreneurs, because that's what we care about very, very much. And you do it in the context of investing and doing that really well. And just really grateful for your time this morning. Thank you.
Amen.
Well, Henry and William, it's been a great delight. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and God bless.
Thank you very much for joining us for today's show. Please go to faithdriveninvestor.org and let us know if you've got any questions at all. Maybe there's some funds you know that we might consider, some issues you'd like to see us tackle. If you have any videos, articles, or podcasts that have also been helpful to you on your journey, I'd love to see them too. Lastly, if this podcast has been an encouragement to you, we'd appreciate you commenting, sharing with others, and subscribing to our podcast or newsletter. This podcast wouldn't be possible without the help from many of our friends, executive producer Justin Foreman and program director Johnny Wills. Music by Carl Kegwell. You can see more of his work at summerdregs.com. Audio and editing by Richard Barley of Cornerstone Church in San Francisco.